Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Local author Emily Gallo writes about the misfits, the forgotten, the eccentrics, the loners, in unconventional and unique settings. Her latest novel takes place on a pot farm in the Emerald Valley of Northern California. These characters, relegated to the margins, not only survive, they thrive, thanks to their generosity and compassion. Emily Gallo, welcome.
Hi, Nancy.
I immediately, because I've read your previous novels, and I know you do research for your novel. For example, one I actually accompanied you when you were going to have one of your characters go line dancing, and you said, I don't know about line dancing. You want to come? I said, yeah, I'll do that.
That was fun that night.
That was fun. So because I know you do research, I wanted to ask you how you researched this book.
Well, the character and the farm were introduced in my previous novel, Murder at the Columbarium, and as you know, I like to kind of not write sequels, but I take characters from before. Yeah.
That we learned to like in your previous novel, and then we pick up your new novel, and they're our favorite characters again.
Right, right. So Dutch, who was the owner of the pot farm of the last resort, was a character in my book, Murder at the Columbarium, and I liked him, and I liked the farm. So the reason I started writing about this is that my daughter and son-in-law have actually growing in Oregon. And so I got acquainted with the whole system and liked the way it all works. Spent some time in Garberville in my past. Noticed trimmers standing on corners in Garberville. Found the whole thing very fascinating. And as you say, research for the book, I went up to Garberville, my husband and I. There's a lovely inn there called the Benbow Inn. I get ideas from talking to people, or like in my daughter's case, but the Benbow Inn was something I hadn't heard of, and somebody in my Pilates class mentioned it to me and when I said I was writing about Garberville. So we went up and stayed at the Benbow Inn, had a lovely time, and spent some time in Garberville and walked around. And then there was a documentary called Murder Mountain, which is about the seedier side of it. So I watched it.
This can be very seedy. These places where, and I learned a new word I didn't know, trimmigrants.
Right.
Where these people come to work and some of them are not so nice as what you describe in your book.
Right. And some of the owners of the farms are not so nice. But I, as you say, I like to show the other side because there's plenty of people growing and doing the right thing, and I want to show them. So that's where I got the idea.
So you were able to go up and observe your daughter's operation and see how things work.
Mm-hmm. Help do some trimming myself.
Oh, you did. You were a trimmigrant.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I thought perhaps you chose this time to write this particular book is because the changes going on in the industry.
Well, that's what if you'll notice in all my books, I don't want to make a huge statement about things, but I like to bring up stuff that's going on in the world at the time. So that is, you know, California made recreational legal this year, and I thought, well, this is the time to write about that. But then
some of the changes I think were unanticipated. I think people had an idea of what the changes would be, but that maybe was not the case.
Well, that's in fact what I write about a little bit in the book is how making it legal has changed things, not always for the better, as far as the farmers are concerned.
Well, since we mentioned that, I do want to start at the beginning of your book, but since we mentioned the business aspect of it, there's a section in your book where, and you mentioned Dutch character in the book, where he talks about these changes, and he prefaces this, he's talking to a guy named Leo, and he says, the pot business is going through a lot of changes with legalization, as you well know. And it happened to be good for the guy he's talking to, but he says, it's not so good for my business. So he's curious and he says, well, why isn't it good for your business? And it was one of those catch-22 situations for those who had been growing illegally for years. So would you pick up there and read from your book?
Big business trying to take over all the licenses, taxes, rules, and regulations. It's a nightmare. and you have to abide by the state rules as well as the county rules, and they don't always mesh. I know all the counties have different regulations. I'm not up on all of them, and they change so often. What are the maximum acres you can grow on Humboldt? 5. That isn't the problem. I've always stayed under 5 acres. Is there a number of plants specified? Leo asked. He had taken his phone out and was taking notes on it. It's all the paperwork I have to do and show them. A site plan, cultivation and operations plan for both outside and inside. And that's just the beginning. Got to have a bunch of permits and documents showing I have agreements with Cal Fire, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the State Water Resources Control Board. There are environmental, zoning, and structural changes that might have to be made. And that's after paying a ridiculous amount of fees. I'd have to wait for the environmental impact study, and that could take up to 2 years. I have one of the nicest residences for trimmers anywhere, but I would have to spend tons of money just to make it ADA compliant. I could go on and on. Are you getting out of the business? Not totally, but I'm going to grow less, just for people I know. I don't need the headaches or the money. I have some other interests that I'd like to follow up on.
This is Emily Gallo, and she's reading from her latest novel, The Last Resort. And you mentioned that this is taking place in Garberville. So would you read the very beginning? Let's start with that setting.
Garberville is a town of less than 1,000 that swells in the fall with an annual migration of young people from all over the world. They are lured by the chance to make thousands of dollars manicuring the marijuana plants that have been cultivated surreptitiously in the forests, farms, and hamlets for decades. The town sits right off the 101 freeway, 200 miles north of San Francisco, in the lush Emerald Triangle, so named because it is the largest cannabis-growing area in the United States. There are so many pot farms that it has been said that everyone's livelihood is somehow dependent on the marijuana industry.
And this is the opening paragraph of Emily Gallo's latest novel, The Last Resort. And we see that this setting in Garberville is really the epicenter of pot growing.
Yes.
In California. Well, now, this character, Dutch, that we mentioned, Dutch Bogart, that moved there in the early 1970s, and he bought this homesteader's farm in the forest and started growing before it was legal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you say he grew up in Southern California and had been writing songs and playing guitar from an early age. So how did you, are you familiar with musicians that, because you include them in your book?
Well, my son-in-law also happens to be a musician, so it was kind of easy to make that work.
And have it be realistic.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you read that section then when Dutch picks up the guitar?
Dutch stopped playing guitar and pushed back his long gray hair when he heard Juniper's car pull up. Harvest season was over, and Juniper had been gone for the last few days, so it had been quiet on the farm. It was just Homer and a couple of trimmigrants from Quebec who had asked to stay on for a few days because they hadn't decided where to travel next. Dutch went outside to greet the arriving trio, giving Juniper a questioning look when he saw a young woman stumbling out of the car. She was so thin and frail that she could have been a child, but Juniper had already told him on the phone that she was in her mid-20s. "This is Scarlett. She needs to rest, so I'll take her to my room for now until we figure out where to put her," Juniper said hastily. She put her arm around Scarlett's shoulder and guided her into the house. Dutch turned to the old black man carrying a battered suitcase and a well-worn guitar case with Buster, Fingerpick, and McCracken written across it and grinned. "It's a real pleasure to meet you, Buster," Dutch said as he reached for his hand to shake. "You've been a real inspiration to me and all my generation of blues guitarists." "You ain't done too bad for yourself either, Dutch. I know your music." "Are you hungry?" Dutch asked. "I wouldn't mind a little something in my stomach. How about a beer or some weed?" Gotta lay off the alcohol, at least until I know I can handle it. Wouldn't mind a toke or two, though.
You know, if you don't mind my interrupting, Emily, when I read that word toke, I started laughing for a completely different reason. I happened to be scrolling through and catch part of the Lawrence Welk show. And these wholesome singers were singing One Toke Over the Line, Sweet Jesus. And I thought, am I hearing right? Lawrence Welk singers singing about a toke? And I used to, years ago, thought they were singing One Toe Over the Line.
I always thought it was
you
toe
thought
also.
So, toe also. Huh. And particularly I thought, oh, these Lawrence Welk singers, they can't possibly know what they're singing about. Well, yeah. Anyway, so I stopped and laughed when I came across that word toke.
Oh, that is funny.
Okay, back to the story.
All right. Come on in my music room. Buster followed Dutch and oohed and aahed over all the musical instruments, recording equipment, and music awards on the wall. Dutch went to the kitchen and came back with an assortment of crackers and cheese. He rolled the joint and passed it to Buster. Buster took a long toke and shook his head. You just never know what the Lord has in store for you. You know, I can't give you much money. I don't need any money, Dutch interrupted. You've been an idol of mine since I was a teenager. You been living up here long? Buster asked. 35 years, give or take. Growing all that time? It's been very lucrative. I didn't always make a lot of money with my music. Buster chuckled. We don't get into that business to make money. You were smart. He looked around the room. You got all this from selling pot? That and some good luck. I ended up writing songs and playing in some bands that did very well in the 70s. That ain't all luck. As I said, you made some wise decisions, and I reckon you didn't let the weed seduce you. I saw too many of my friends and peers throw away their lives and careers. I stayed in control. Dutch grinned. Buster smiled at Dutch and nodded. He picked up his guitar case and opened it. Dutch got his guitar off its stand and started playing Sweet Home Chicago. Buster joined in.
My first guest is local author Emily Gallo, whose latest novel is The Last Resort. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, novelist Emily Gallo. Well, you weave this story, and all these various characters come in, and you have Dutch and Buster being guitarists. So would you continue there where Buster and Dutch then are finishing up a set of old blues numbers?
Buster and Dutch finished up a set of old blues numbers. Did Juniper tell you where she found me? Buster asked. Not really, just that you'd hit on some bad times. Buster cackled. You could say that. My manager and record label screwed me big time. I got a small Social Security check, and that covered rent in a crappy hotel in the Tenderloin. Anything more than that was from whatever I earned busking. Busking? Dutch asked. I've been spending my days playing in a BART station. Dutch shook his head. Man, how long have you been doing that? Buster shrugged. Got a little too close to the bottle for a time, so I don't remember. Some years. My manager took it all, and the record company claimed I owed them, so I couldn't play any clubs or concerts. All the money I earned would have gone to them. You're saving my life letting me stay here. I'm too old to live like that. Well, I'm glad Juniper found you. What's her story, anyway? She didn't tell you on the drive up here? Dutch asked. Not much. She only said that she hadn't been down to San Francisco for a long time. Yeah, she doesn't like being reminded of her crappy childhood in the city. She lived in foster homes until she was 18. She spent her 20s hitchhiking around the West Coast and finally found trimming marijuana to be a lucrative seasonal job. The rural life agreed with her, so she ended up staying here. She bought a horse and learned all aspects of the pot business and has become what they call a trim mama. Buster chuckled. Trim mama? She handles all the trimmers during harvest season. She also takes care of the house so I can focus on the growing and the business end. You're still doing music, ain't you? Here and there, an occasional gig, and I'm still writing songs for others. Juniper said there's a guy named Homer who lives here, too. She said he's an old guy like me. Yeah, Homer's an old carny. Did electrical work for the circus, too, so he's handy here when he can get around. He's got Parkinson's disease. Oh, man, that's awful. Like that actor guy, Michael J. something, Muhammad Ali had it too, didn't he? Dutch nodded. Weed helps his tremors, and so does listening to and playing music. Even dancing. It's pretty amazing. And that's true. I've watched a YouTube of a man with Parkinson's smoking pot and how his tremors just stopped and he could stand up. And I've watched also YouTube of people dancing and the tremors stop. And my piano teacher, Glenn, had a guy with Parkinson's who he was teaching piano to. And when he played the piano, the tremors stopped. So that was just amazing.
Well, this is what I meant by your research. I knew that behind this novel, that there's so much truth here, fact, mm-hmm. in your novel because of the research that you do. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty amazing. Later you mention, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it, Ibogaine. Is that how you pronounce the drug?
Ibogaine is what I call it, mm-hmm. yeah.
That Homer uses also.
And that was a CBS Sunday Morning TV show that showed them using it for other purposes, for depression and people that are facing cancer deaths. And they use it, and so I started researching it, and lo and behold, they also use it for Parkinson's.
So you included that?
Right. Yeah. And a music festival.
Yeah. Well, you, I don't know if I should give away, there's this very special guitar that Dutch has.
Probably not.
Okay, we won't spoil that but for the readers.
Reader needs to know. It's something very interesting at the end. Had you known that story?
I did, actually. I knew, I think I heard it on NPR report.
Uh-huh.
This guy's name, I won't say his name, but his death was a little... not mysterious, but they weren't quite sure how he died, but he was quite young.
Uh-huh.
And so something that had belonged to him would be a valuable.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, we won't give that away. There are other things that happen in your book that we don't want to spoil the surprise, but is there anything else you want to say about
this book? Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about Luther.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
It was August 1998. And Luther was waiting to start college in September. After dinner, he went to the playground to join a pickup basketball game. There were several people playing, some of whom he'd seen before, but no one he knew personally. When it got too dark to see, they asked if he wanted to join them for a beer. Luther didn't have a car, so a couple of them offered him a ride. They stopped at a convenience store to buy a case of beer. Luther stayed in the car while the other two went inside. Two shots rang out.
This is novelist Emily Gallo, and she's written five previous novels. This one is The Last Resort, and you have Luther, this young man who was young when he got accused, sent to prison for a crime he did not commit, but now he's out. And as I'm reading your story, I was, delighted is a word, to see that he runs into a character that we met in a previous novel of yours. That's a nice guy. Where does Luther go?
Well, he wants to go visit his mother, who is in the columbarium.
His mother's deceased.
Mother's deceased, so she's in an urn in the niche in the columbarium. And my second book is called The Columbarium, and then we have Murder at the Columbarium. And my favorite character of all my novels is Jed.
He is
and
a sweetheart.
He runs the columbarium, basically. So
he's the caretaker.
He's the caretaker.
And you might tell people what a columbarium is, because I've asked just my own little survey, informal survey, and people said, nope, never heard of it.
And it's amazing. 99% of people have never heard of it. And I had never heard of it. That's another one. I had a friend who... That's how I got involved in that. It's just hearing from one little thing from somebody.
That intrigues you and you follow up on it?
Columbariums are all over the world, and it's a place with niches where people put urns with ashes of their loved ones.
So Luther's mother's ashes are in this—
San Francisco Columbarium, which, by the way, is an incredible building, and I tell everyone I know, if you're going to the city, you need to go see that building. And everyone I've sent there has been just like, oh, my God, I was there for hours. It's so incredible. So anyway, he does. He goes to see his mother's ashes and meets Jed. And Jed's the one who tells him about the Garberville farm. And Luther joins the crowd, the group.
So Luther makes his way up to this pot farm that is the last resort, because these are people who have a lot of trouble in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Dutch takes them in, and Luther becomes one of these characters. But now he's been in prison for 20 years. What can he do?
Exactly. And he learns, and he's willing and happy to be there and learns how to do all the things he never had a chance to do.
And this is what I mean by your characters being likable people, because here's this guy that he really has no skills. He doesn't even have a telephone, doesn't know how to work a telephone or know he should check it for messages. But yet he's willing to help in whatever way he can. There's so many times it come up and Luther volunteers, can I help you do this? Can I help here? And so he's a likable character. He's down on his luck, as are all these other people, but they're so likable.
And that's kind of the point, I guess, I'm trying to get across, that, you know, you got to look beyond, look beyond the outside. I mean, his whole family, other than his mother, disowned him, thinking he was a murderer.
Yeah.
And
well, since we mentioned the columbarium, I'd like to give you a chance to tell us about Murder at the Columbarium. You mentioned that your second novel was entitled as The Columbarium, and then you have now Murder at the Columbarium, which was the novel before the Pot Farm book that we were just talking about. And there's an overlap, because Luther, in The Last Resort, makes his way to the columbarium and meets this nice guy, Jed, who's the caretaker there. So would you read a little bit of Murder in the Columbarium?
Jed was unlocking the front gate of the columbarium when he thought he heard a cat in distress. He peered around into the typical San Francisco gray, misty morning, but saw nothing. He pulled the key from the lock, pushed open the gate, and started walking toward the front door. The strange noise was now clearly near his feet. When he stooped to look, he didn't find a cat, but an infant swaddled in a pink blanket. He froze for a moment, caught up in a fast track of repressed memory, and then he brushed the branches away to lift the baby. The tableau widened and darkened with the sweep of his arm. There was a black shoe lying on the ground, and a few inches away, he noticed a leg, and then saw it was attached to the body of a woman. "Oh," Jed gasped. The woman wore a long black embroidered dress, and there was a hijab wrapped tightly around her neck. Her eyes were open, but staring straight ahead, vacantly. Jed pressed the infant tightly to his chest. Jed was a tall, sinewy African-American in his early 60s. He was one of those people who turned heads, not because of his good looks, but for his aloofness and the general air of mystery about him. Slowly, he pulled himself together and started rocking the baby. The baby's mewling softened as he walked into the office and sat down at his desk. His only thought was to soothe the baby. He wished he had a rocking chair, but maybe the swivel action of the office chair would work. Jed wasn't new to soothing babies in pain, and he was good at it. His brain skimmed through his limited repertoire of songs to come up with an appropriate one, and landed on Amazing Grace. Maybe that one was a little too appropriate. He started to sing. After the baby quieted down, Jed realized he needed to call the police. He dialed 911. "I am the caretaker of the columbarium on Lorraine Court, and I just got to work. I found a dead body and a baby lying next to it. They were lying outside the building." He took a deep breath. It had been a long time since he needed to use his pranayama breathing. "Yes, the baby is alive. My name, Jed Gibbons." He hung up and continued to breathe and rock the baby until he heard the distant sound of sirens. Then he stood up and walked outside, cradling the now cooing baby. An ambulance arrived first, closely followed by two police cars and a fire truck. Why did they need to send a fire truck whenever they sent an ambulance? And why did they dispatch two police cars? Isn't there enough crime in the city of San Francisco to keep the police busy enough for them to go on separate calls? A dead body hardly warranted all of that. He approached the cars and trucks just as the EMTs were stepping out of the ambulance. "You the guy who called?" one of them asked as he approached Jed. "Yes, I'm the caretaker. It's over here." Jed led the way to the woman's body. Three policemen followed behind, sauntering and talking among themselves. Jed stepped aside after pulling the branches away to expose the body. The baby started wailing again, and he sang softly while patting her back. One of the policemen approached Jed. "The baby was with the body?" "Yes, that's how I found the body. I heard the crying." "When did you get here?" "About 15 minutes ago." The policeman nodded and went back to his patrol car. Jed noticed him speaking into the radio. A couple of minutes later, the cop returned to where Jed was waiting. "The detectives will be here shortly to ask you some more questions." Jed nodded and turned his attention back to the EMTs. They had confirmed that the woman was dead, and they were now chatting nonchalantly with the firemen and policemen. The whole scene seemed surreal. He hadn't had a PTSD episode in a long time. Each time he had one, he was brought back to the escape from Jonestown more than 40 years ago. The screaming and gunshots, and then the running. His heart pounded. He had difficulty swallowing. His head throbbed, and he gasped for breath. Jed resumed his pranayama breathing. After getting his emotions under control, he asked, "What about the baby?" "We'll call Family and Children's Services. They'll bring her to the hospital and have her checked out and then find a foster home till we can locate the family. I assume it's a she since the blanket's pink." "I guess so. I haven't looked," Jed answered. He walked away and took out his cell phone. He dialed Monica's number and told his wife what was happening. As he spoke to her, he looked down at the baby's face and saw a sweet smile. Jed smiled back and pulled her up to his chest. "How awful. Are you okay?" Monica asked. "Yes, I'm fine. Do you want me to come down there?" "No, I'll call you when I know more." He hung up and watched as two more cars pulled up. One a Ford Escape, the other a Toyota Prius. Two men in suits got out of the Escape, and a young woman got out of the Prius. Jed figured out pretty quickly who was who. The woman got there first. "Are you Jed Gibbons?" "Yes. I'm Elizabeth Halifax. I'm a social worker with the city. I can take the baby." She reached for the baby, and Jed handed her over. "What hospital will you bring her to?" he asked. "San Francisco General." He nodded and turned toward the two detectives who had just appeared next to him. "Jed Gibbons?" the portly, balding, middle-aged white one asked. "Yes." Jed spent the next half hour relating how he stumbled upon the body and answered a plethora of what he considered unnecessary questions. He finally interrupted them. "I need to call the Neptune Society to let them know what's happened. They run the columbarium. I assume I won't be opening today." "That's correct. Go ahead and call them, but don't go anywhere. We'll need to take you downtown." That was the other one, a thin Hispanic man who looked to be in his 30s. "Why?" "You're a witness." "I'm not a witness. I just found the body, and I've already answered a lot of questions." "We need to get your answers on tape, and you're the only witness so far." "Anyway, wasn't the gate locked?" the other detective asked. "Yes." "Hmm. Then how did she get in?" He raised his eyebrows. "And how did the murderer get in?" That was the moment that Jed grasped the seriousness of his situation.
This is Emily Gallo, and she's reading from her book, Murder at the Columbarium. And here's this nice man who's the caretaker at the Columbarium, finds a body, and he didn't do it. He didn't kill this woman. So he doesn't suspect that they might suspect him of having done it. And so that's a shock to him, but...
That's kind of what plays through the book and trying to find the who it was, who did it.
Now, was there anything that... This is totally from your imagination. I mean, the Columbarium is a real place.
Right. This came because when I finished the previous book...
So you have five previous novels besides the latest ones. Now you have six.
Yes, so there's six altogether.
Six novels.
Anyway, it was just... usually something happens as I'm writing one book and I say... Oh, that's my next book. So when I finished Roads Untaken, I was talking to my husband and I was like, I'm not sure exactly what I want to write right now. So he said, well, why don't you write a mystery? I said, I don't know. Oh, okay. And that's how it started. And because Jed's my very favorite character, I hadn't written specifically about Jed. Jed appears in every book, but... for a while, and I missed him. So I said, well, I'm going to figure out a mystery about Jed, and that's how it all happened.
So he mentions that the Neptune Society, he says, chapter two starts, Jed called the Neptune Society board president and gave a brief account of what had happened. So I'm sure this is true, that the Neptune Society oversees the Columbarium.
Right, right. That was all done for the research for the Columbarium book.
Mm-hmm. And so you'd already researched how this is set up.
Right.
This place called the Columbarium.
Right.
Well, we'll have to read your mystery. I'll remind listeners again that the book you were just reading from, Murder at the Columbarium, takes place in San Francisco. And your very last novel, The Last Resort, which takes place in Northern California, the Emerald Triangle, on a pot farm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Emily. After a break, I'll be talking to author Brian T. Marshall, whose latest novel is Choosing the Dark. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Local author Brian T. Marshall set his third novel in San Francisco, and it also includes characters who live on the margins, who choose to live in the dark. This scene attracts a spoiled white kid from Marin who finished with high school in Mill Valley. Brian T. Marshall's newest novel is Choosing the Dark. Brian Marshall, welcome.
Great to be back.
Now, you are a member of a writer's group here in the North State, and tell us about this writer's group.
North State Writers, it's great whether you're just thinking about becoming a writer or a semi-experienced pro. We have speakers every month. We have all sorts of critique groups. We do events. We just recently did an event at the Blue Room Theater involving live readings of some stories and essays. We just basically want to encourage any way we can people to get out there and get off their butts and write.
Well, now, the campfire was pretty horrendous for just across the board for the, this area. Did it affect your writers group?
Yeah, we lost about 25% of our ensemble, people moving out of state or out of the area. But so far, we've gained that many people back, new people checking it out, which is really encouraging.
Well, I want to ask you about your newest novel, because you have two previous novels. And this one is Choosing the Dark. And I'd like for you to read a little bit, if you would, from this newest novel. You, in the front of the book, you have Ars moriendi, ars vivendi est.
As in death, so in life. Basically, the book is a study of how you, someone who's just starting out in life, but who learns about life by encountering death for the first time. So I wanted to play both sides of that coin.
Yeah. So you start with this phrase in Latin.
Right.
Okay, now, kind of set the tone for us for your book. And this is in your prologue. Would you read a section there?
Certainly. He rarely makes it back to the city, hates what it's become, a theme park for the privileged, a binary world of rich and poor, just like their ones and zeros. But it always wasn't like this. Way back when, in Pleistocene times, there were people who lived on the margins, people for whom having little, caring less, wasn't an outcome, but a choice. A decision to live in the dark, to shout and sneer and flail away, burning at both ends. Love, as it turned out, wasn't the answer, and so they'd tried something else, something that tasted like Drano and sounded like a scream.
This is Brian T. Marshall reading from his latest novel, Choosing the Dark. And you mention in this paragraph a decision to live in the dark.
To me, that's basically what the whole punk music scene was and the affiliate social groups. The summer of love had basically fizzled out by that point. There was a lot of political unrest. And any cycle, when as soon as the emergence of life force, then there always seemed to be a dark force counteracting. Also, this just as punk was kind of experiencing its second growth, the AIDS epidemic began to hit San Francisco. So that was a second wave of negative energy. So I'm trying to examine how those waves affected society and our protagonist, Rob.
So this protagonist, and his name is Rob, is an interesting character. And you have a section a little later in your book. You say he uncovers an essential truth. Would you read that for us, Brian?
Sure. Through it all, these long, aimless rambles, he uncovers an essential truth. Being alone and being lonely, they're not nearly the same thing. And living in a city, even if you barely know a soul, even if all you get by on are quick little glances, conversations overheard, the scraps of others' meals, well, still, that can be enough. Sometimes he feels invincible, too big for his own skin, as if the streets only know themselves through his eyes, his ears, his presence. And other times he could swear he's a ghost. Like maybe he died a while back, with no bell to toll his departure. Just the sound of those white rubber soles slapping the pavement, finding a wall, bouncing back a second later. Like some jittery heartbeat. Pit-pat, pit-pat, pit-pat.
So this scene in a city, you make the point that being alone and being lonely are not nearly the same thing.
Yeah, I just know when I was that age, there are times when I was just all alone taking walks, doing things that should have made me feel insignificant or small, but instead I felt expansive. I felt like I said, like the city was living through me. And I wanted to get that sense, that crazy adolescent sense of like you think you're bigger than the universe at the same time when you think you're insignificant.
So did you grow up in San Francisco?
No, actually, I grew up in Los Angeles Bay Area. I went to college in Santa Cruz, and while I was still in Santa Cruz, started doing the San Francisco club scene as a musician.
What did you play?
Bass.
So you have your characters. You know this music scene.
Yeah, not as well as some, but I had enough to have some cred in the book.
So that you could write about this scene. Well, you say, again, being alone and being lonely are not the same thing. So you're saying that when you were this age, you were alone but not lonely.
Correct. I mean, yeah, still there's times you're lonely. Maybe you're thinking about the person, the girl you'd rather be with or the friend you're missing. But like I say, I think for the first time you're starting to come into your own and come to realize you can be your own best companion sometimes.
Well, you mentioned later in the book, there's only one person who knows where he works. Now, you're talking about your character. And somebody here to see you hanging around back. There's only one person who knows where he works. His heart picks up a notch. But when he peers through the ratty screen door, he sees it's not Annie after all.
Nope. You know, this introduces Kurt, who is our sort of rock and roll front man, poet, and general crazy person.
Spelled with a K.
Kurt with a K. Well, of course. It's the European way. Anyway, here we go. No, it's some guy. Late 20s, early 30s. It's kind of hard to tell. As thin, as gaunt, as a crayon stick figure, the kind you drew back in third grade. Vampire skin, cut glass cheeks, black hair and a tight ponytail. A look that should probably come off as swish, but on him it says militant. His jeans are ragged, more white than blue. His boots are scuffed and battered. A sleeveless black tee that shows off his arms, lightly muscled and snaked with veins.
This is Brian T. Marshall, and he writes novels. This is his third novel called Choosing the Dark, and you have musicians in your story. Now, this guy, Kurt, what role does he play?
Basically, he's the guy that anybody who's ever been in a band knows very well, sort of the egocentric frontman. Originally, he was just going to be kind of a foil, but as I started to write the character, he did that thing that characters love to do, which is decide who he was, and it wasn't who I thought he was at first. So he became much more pretentious, artistic, learned in a very showy way, and it's one of the central arcs of the book is his struggle first with ego and then with drugs. And basically, he gets more and more deranged, kind of indicating what was happening to the music scene at the time as well.
So this character takes on a life of his own, really.
Yeah, basically, and his moral struggle becomes one of the central ones of the book. Originally, he's more of a write-off character, but I've decided he had earned his right to have a sincere moral crisis that he had to overcome.
Well, a little later in the book, you write, at this point, Rob knows what's expected of him, but somehow that would feel all wrong, throwing candy down into the void. And here you just were telling us who this Kurt character is, and now Kurt speaks in this section of your book. Would you read that section?
Sure. No, the only thing I can give them, Kurt goes on, give anyone really, is this, an act, a performance. They come to watch the wreck in slow motion, the dog whirring at his chain. And they're curious, what will he be like tonight? Angry or sad? Aloof or engaged? Would you like fries with that? He pauses, looks at Rob, so more like through him. Did I ever tell you I put on shows back when I was a child? With costumes and props and music, of course, and I do all the parts. Me talking back and forth to myself, just like I'm doing now. But you know what the hardest part was? Imagining them, the people watching. At least they don't have to worry about that anymore.
And this is a character in the book Choosing the Dark, and this character is named Kurt. And the author is Brian T. Marshall. So if we skip on a little farther over in your book, you say that you're writing about a character who realizes most people there have no clue as to who he is, have any way of knowing that Rob and Kurt, however briefly, were in a band together. Still, he doesn't mind. So you say being invisible has its advantages. Did you ever sometimes wish to be invisible?
Well, I think that's the art of being a writer is you're there in the scene, but you're not of the scene. And you're always kind of sitting back and trying to see, wow, what's that person wearing? What do they talk like? So I have achieved invisibility on occasion.
Well, why don't you read this section when you're saying being invisible has its advantages?
Sure. The chief one being that those unseen, they see the world more clearly. Like tonight, gazing around that cavernous room, reading all those faces, he realizes how fleeting it is, how this rebellion, this lashing out, this claim of being somehow different, it'll fade like everything else, ending for most of its combatants not in death or drama or some grand gesture, more in a series of compromises, or call them surrenders instead. A gradual slide into something much quieter, a job at a bank, a week in Cancun, becoming the person you disdain.
So you're putting words into your character's mouth, so you get a chance.
What I try to do is make it a third-person narrative, but make everything seen through Rob's eyes. So you'll notice there's not a single scene that happens in the book that Rob isn't participating in or witnessing. And I try to make the language something a 17-year-old kid would use. So if there's a four-syllable word, find a one-syllable word instead. Use simple, approachable metaphors. Make it kind of like his thought process is channeling or filtering everything the reader sees.
Now, I mentioned his background, but remind us, this character Rob has a different background from these other characters.
He grew up in Marin, fairly privileged. His mom is a classical music composer, working at UC Berkeley. His dad, conversely, is a woodworker, so that's got an interesting dynamic going there. But yeah, he's open-minded, he's accessible, but yeah, he's a little bit spoiled and privileged. And one of the struggles of the book is him coming to grips with this hard-edged, rough scene that he's got to somehow fit into and adapt to.
Because he could have stayed in this privileged situation in Marin County.
Well, that's what his mother would have wanted, and they have a conflict over that, so.
And the very title of your book is Choosing the Dark.
Right, because, yeah, like basically he's a very sunny disposition and that kind of buoys the book along, but a lot of the themes he's dealing with or the actions of the characters are pretty dark and nihilistic.
Well, you've written, this is your third novel, Brian, so you must be working on another novel right now.
Yes, I am. After several false starts, I think this one might reach conclusion, but you never know. They're delicate things.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that these characters take on a life of their own.
So, yeah. Basically, you want to have a tight plot. You want to have a sense of where you're going, but you have to have some flexibility on the journey, or else it just becomes you're taking dictation rather than writing. So you really need to listen to what the character's doing, get a sense of the book. Sometimes make decisions. Oh, it's getting slow here. We need to pump it up here. Or you know, we've had too much dialogue in this chapter. We need to go ahead and do more narrative. There's just all little like. Tight, just like you're driving down a car, there's all sorts of little micro adjustments you have to make to keep in the lane.
The book again, the title is Choosing the Dark. This is a novel by Brian T. Marshall. And you might again tell us how you participate with the writer's group. What's your role with the writer's group?
I'm theoretically the vice president. Our vice president standing disappeared, so I kind of took over. I'm also the events coordinator, so like I try, I'm organize that event at the Blue Room, the Live Word event. Try to come up with the activities. I'm always amazed for as great an artistic community as Chico, there's also a lot of fragmentation and people who are into books aren't necessarily into music. People who are into music might not be into art. So I really like the idea of cross-pollinization. To me, when the arts interact across boundaries, that's where you get the really interesting, get the sparks flying. And that's why the Blue Room event was fun because it's a bunch of actors and a bunch of writers collaborating together.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Thank you, Brian.
Sure, thanks.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. And again, your latest novel is Choosing the Dark, a novel by Brian T. Marshall. And now here's Richard Parker with a few words about pot.
It's getting to the point where you can't depend on the person you're talking to being able to remember the 60s or even the 70s. I recall before I retired from the classroom that I came to realize my students thought of the Vietnam War the way I thought of the Great Depression, something that happened well before my time. The kids in my classes thought my recollections of my own student days were quaint, although in fact they were suffused with a constant background anxiety felt by all my male contemporaries, namely fear of the draft. But the draft and the war in Vietnam were just a part of life at the time, even if a particularly unpleasant part. A more pleasant part was one's introduction to marijuana. Now, these days, with state after state passing laws legalizing the recreational use of the weed, and with shops opening up to dispense all manner of marijuana extracts, and with the prospect of making nearly anything out of hemp, from pain-reducing creams to automobile bumpers, it's quaint, I suppose, to remember that back when, we believed it was fairly safe to grow a marijuana plant or two in the backyard because the police, we firmly believed, could not distinguish them from tomato plants. Fortunately, nobody I know ever put this piece of nonsense to the test. Well, back in that quaint time and place of my introduction to the plant, it wasn't quite the weed with roots in hell that the United States Congress thought it was. It was fairly innocuous, at least as I recall, and to the extent it had much effect, it mainly made you act a bit sillier than usual. And then I moved to the West Coast. And a friend who'd been in the Peace Corps received a plastic jug from India that was packed full of ganja, pot that bore little resemblance to the stuff we'd get from kids down in the holler back home. I remember the first time I tried it. I treated it like the mild stuff I was used to, taking big drags and holding it in so you had to talk in that high, squeaky voice that told everybody just how far the joint had got around the circle. Well, surprise! This, it turned out, really was the weed with roots in hell, or at least with tentacles in your subconscious. I discovered I was particularly susceptible to the effects of THC when administered in doses designed to help Indian mystics have glimpses of new worlds and different dimensions. Having no interest in either new worlds nor different dimensions, I pretty much gave it up for a long time and have used it since only in small amounts as an aid to sleep. However, in that fortunate way that things sometimes work out, the discovery that powerful pot was not my thing happened about the same time I made another discovery, the dry martini. So finding assistance in sitting back and relaxing after a tense day has always been possible. And even though today has not been particularly tense or troublesome, these remarks have put me in mind of my favorite watering hole down the block. So, this is Richard Parker.
Thank you, Richard Parker. I would also like to thank my first guests, novelists Emily Gallo and Brian T. Marshall.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.